Chapter 17. Discovering them, and the multiplied orders that had resulted from their rivalry. Of course they're simply furious with each other, Mrs. Melrose and Mrs. Gillow, especially because each one pretends to have been the first to notice his spring snowstorm, apostrophe, and in reality it wasn't either of them, but only poor Bill Haslett, an art critic we've known for years, who chanced on the picture and rushed off to tell a dealer who was looking for a new painter to push. Grace suddenly raised her soft myopic eyes to Susie's face. Do you know, the funny thing is that I believe Nat is beginning to forget this, and to believe that it was Mrs. Melrose who stopped short in front of his picture on the opening day, and screamed out, "This is genius! Apostrophe, apostrophe, it seems funny he should care so much, when I've always known he had genius, and he has known it too. But they're all so kind to him, and Mrs. Melrose especially. And I suppose it makes a thing sound new to hear it said in a new voice." Susie looked at her meditatively. "Andy, how should you feel if Nat liked too much to hear Mrs. Melrose say it? Too much, I mean, to care any longer what you felt or thought?" Her friend's worn face flushed quickly and then paled. Susie almost repented the question. But Mrs. Fulmer met it with a tranquil dignity. "You haven't been married long enough, dear, to understand. ... how people like Nat and me feel about such things. ... or how trifling they seem, in the balance of one's memories." Susie stood up again, and flung her arms about her friend. Grace, she laughed with wet eyes, "how can you be as wise as that, and yet not have sense enough to buy a decent hat?" She gave Mrs. Fulmer a quick embrace and hurried away. She had learned her lesson after all, but it was not exactly the one she had come to seek. The week she had allowed herself had passed, and still there was no word from Nick. She allowed herself yet another day, and that too went by without a letter. She then decided on a step from which her pride had hitherto recoiled. She would call at the bank and ask for Nick's address. She called, embarrassed and hesitating, and was told, after inquiries in the post office department, that Mr. Nicholas Lansing had given no address since that of the Palazzo Vanderlyn, 3 months previously. She went back to Versailles that afternoon with the definite intention of writing to Stratford, unless the next morning's post brought a letter. The next morning brought nothing from Nick, but a scribbled message from Mrs. Melrose. "Would Susie, as soon as possible, come into her room for a word?" Susie jumped up, hurried through her bath, and knocked at her hostess's door. In the immense low bed that faced the rich umbrage of the park, Mrs. Melrose lay smoking cigarettes and glancing over her letters. She looked up with her vague smile, and said dreamily, "Susie, darling, have you any particular plans for the next few months, I mean?" Susie colored. She knew the intonation of old, and fancied she understood what it implied. "Plans, dearest? Any number. I'm tearing myself away the day after tomorrow. To the Gillows Moor, very probably," she hastened to announce. Instead of the relief she had expected to read on Mrs. Melrose's dramatic countenance, she discovered there the blankest disappointment. "Oh, really? That's too bad. Is it absolutely settled, as far as I'm concerned?" said Susie crisply. The other sighed. "I'm too sorry. You see, dear, I'd meant to ask you to stay on here quietly and look after the Fulmer children. Fulmer and I are going to Spain next week. I want to be with him when he makes his studies, receives his first impressions. Such a marvelous experience, to be there when he and Velasquez meet." She broke off, lost in prospective ecstasy. "Andy, you see, as Grace Fulmer insists on coming with us." "Ah, I see. Well, there are the 5 children, such a problem," sighed the benefactress. "If you were at a loose end, you know, dear, while Nick's away with his friends, I could really make it worth your while. So awfully good of you, Violet, only I'm not, as it happens." Oh, the relief of being able to say that, gaily, firmly, and even truthfully. take charge of the Fomer children, indeed. Susie remembered how Nick and Essie had fled from them that autumn afternoon in New Hampshire. The offer gave her a salutary glimpse of the way in which, as the years passed, and she lost her freshness and novelty, she would more and more be used as a convenience, a stopgap, writer of notes, runner of errands, nursery governess or companion. She called to mind several elderly women of her acquaintance, pensioners of her own group, who still wore its livery, struck its attitudes, and chattered its jargon, but had long since been ruthlessly relegated to the slave and offices. Never in the world would she join their numbers. Mrs. Melrose's face fell, and she looked at Susie with the plaintive bewilderment of the wielder of millions to whom everything that cannot be bought is imperceptible. "But I can't see why you can't change your plans," she murmured with a soft persistency. "Ah, well, you know," Susie paused on a slow inward smile, "they are not mine only, as it happens." Mrs. Melrose's brow clouded. The unforeseen complication of Mrs. Fomer's presence on the journey had evidently tried her nerves, and this new obstacle to her arrangements shook her faith in the divine order of things. "Your plans are not yours only? But surely you won't let Ursula Gillow dictate to you? There's my jade pendant, the one you said you liked the other day. The Fomers won't go with me, you understand, unless they're satisfied about the children. The whole plan will fall through. Susie, darling, you were always too unselfish. I hate to see you sacrificed to Ursula." Susie's smile lingered. Time was when she might have been glad to add the jade pendant to the collection already enriched by Ellie Vanderlyn's sapphires. More recently, she would have resented the offer as an insult to her newly found principles. But already the mere fact that she might henceforth, if she chose, be utterly out of reach of such bribes, enabled her to look down on them with tolerance. Oh, the blessed moral freedom that wealth conferred! She recalled Mrs. Fomer's uncontrollable cry. "The most wonderful thing of all is not having to contrive and skimp, and give up something every single minute. Yes, it was only on such terms that one could call one's soul one's own." The sense of it gave Susie the grace to answer amicably. "If I could possibly help you out, Violet, I shouldn't want a present to persuade me. And, as you say, there's no reason why I should sacrifice myself to Ursula, or to anybody else. Only, as it happens," she paused and took the plunge, "I'm going to England, because I've promised to see a friend." That night she wrote to Strefford. XVI, stretched out under an awning on the deck of the Ibis, Nick Lansing looked up for a moment at the vanishing cliffs of Malta, and then plunged again into his book. He had had nearly 3 weeks of drug taking on the Ibis. The drugs he had absorbed were of two kinds. Visions of fleeing landscapes, looming up from the blue sea, to vanish into it again, and visions of study absorbed from the volumes piled up day and night at his elbow. For the first time in months he was in reach of a real library, just the kind of scholarly yet miscellaneous library that his restless and impatient spirit craved. He was aware that the books he read, like the fugitive scenes on which he gazed, were merely a form of anesthetic. He swallowed them with the careless greed of the sufferer who seeks only to still pain and deaden memory. But they were beginning to produce in him a moral languor that was not disagreeable, that, indeed, compared with the fierce pain of the first days, was almost pleasurable. It was exactly the kind of drug that he needed. There is probably no point on which the average man has more definite views than on the uselessness of writing a letter that is hard to write. And the line he had sent to Susie from Genoa, Nick had told her that she would hear from him again in a few days. But when the few days had passed, and he began to consider setting himself to the task, he found 50 reasons for postponing it. Had there been any practical questions, to write about it would have been different. He could not have borne for 24 hours the idea that she was in uncertainty as to money. But that had all been settled long ago. From the first as he had had the administering of their modest fortune. On their marriage, Nick's own meager income, paid in, none too regularly, by the agent who had managed for years the dwindling family properties, had been transferred to her. It was the only wedding present he could make. And the wedding checks had of course all been deposited in her name. There were therefore no useless reasons for communicating with her, and when it came to reasons of another order the mere thought of them benumbed him. For the first few days he reproached himself for his inertia, then he began to seek reasons for justifying it. After all, for both their sakes a waiting policy might be the wisest he could pursue. He had left Susie because he could not tolerate the conditions on which he had discovered their life together to be based, and he had told her so. What more was there to say? Nothing was changed in their respective situations. If they came together it could be only to resume the same life, and that, as the days went by, seemed to him more and more impossible. He had not yet reached the point of facing a definite separation. But whenever his thoughts traveled back over their past life he recoiled from any attempt to return to it. As long as this state of mind continued there seemed nothing to add to the letter he had already written, except indeed the statement that he was cruising with the Hickses. And he saw no pressing reason for communicating that. To the Hickses he had given no hint of his situation. When Coral Hicks, a fortnight earlier, had picked him up in the broiling streets of Genoa, and carried him off to the Ibis, he had thought only of a cool dinner and perhaps a moonlight sail. Then, in reply to their friendly urging, he had confessed that he had not been well but indeed gone off hurriedly for a few days' change of air, and that left him without defense against the immediate proposal that he should take his change of air on the Ibis. They were just off to Corsica and Sardinia, and from there to Sicily. He could rejoin the railway at Naples, and be back at Venice in 10 days. 10 days of respite. The temptation was irresistible. And he really liked the kind uncomplicated Hickses. A wholesome honesty and simplicity breathed through all their opulence, as if the rich trappings of their present life still exhaled the fragrance of their native prairies. The mere fact of being with such people was like a purifying bath. When the yacht touched at Naples he agreed, since they were so awfully kind, to go on to Sicily. And when the chief steward, going ashore at Naples for the last time, before they got up steam, said, "My letters for the post, sir," he answered, as he had answered at each previous halt. "Oh, thank you. None." Now they were heading for Rhodes and Crete, where he had never been, where he had so often longed to go. In spite of the lateness of the season the weather was still miraculously fine. The short waves danced ahead under a sky without a cloud, and the strong bows of the Ibis hardly swayed as she flew forward over the flying crests. Only his hosts and their daughter were on the yacht, of course, with Eldorada Tooker and Mr. Beck in attendance. An eminent archaeologist, who was to have joined them at Naples, had telegraphed an excuse at the last moment, and Nick noticed that, while Mrs. Hicks was perpetually apologizing for the great man's absence, Coral merely smiled and said nothing. As a matter of fact, Mr. and Mrs. Hicks were never as pleasant as when one had them to oneself. In company, Mr. Hicks ran the risk of appearing over-hospitable, and Mrs. Hicks confused dates and names in the desire to embrace all culture in her conversation. But alone with Nick, their old traveling companion, they shone out in their native simplicity, and Mr. Hicks talked soundly of investments, and Mrs. Hicks recalled her early married days in Apex City, when, on being brought home to her new house in Eschalus Avenue, her first thought had been, "How on earth shall I get all those windows washed?" The loss of Mr. Buttles had been as serious to them as Nick had supposed. Mr. Beck could never hope to replace him. Apart from his mysterious gift of languages, and his almost superhuman faculty for knowing how to address letters to eminent people, and in what terms to conclude them, he had a smattering of archaeology and general culture on which Mrs. Hicks had learned to depend her own memory being, alas, so inadequate to the range of her interests. Her daughter might perhaps have helped her, but it was not Miss Hicks' way to mother her parents. She was exceedingly kind to them, but left them, as it were, to bring themselves up as best they could, while she pursued her own course of self-development. A somber zeal for knowledge filled the mind of this strange girl. She appeared interested only in fresh opportunities of adding to her store of facts. They were illuminated by little imagination and less poetry, but, carefully catalogued and neatly sorted in her large, cool brain, they were always as accessible as the volumes in an up-to-date public library. To Nick there was something reposeful in this lucid intellectual curiosity. He wanted, above all things, to get away from sentiment, from seduction, from the moods and impulses and flashing contradictions that were Susie. Susie was not a great reader. Her store of facts was small, and as he had grown up among people who dreaded ideas as much as if they had been a contagious disease. But, in the early days especially, when Nick had put a book in her hand, or read a poem to her, her swift intelligence had instantly shed a new light on the subject, and, penetrating to its depths, had extracted from them whatever belonged to her. What a pity that this exquisite insight, this intuitive discrimination, should for the most part have been spent upon reading the thoughts of vulgar people, and extracting a profit from them should have been wasted, since her childhood, on all the hideous intricacies of aging. And visible beauty, how she cared for that too. He had not guessed it, or rather he had not been sure of it, till the day when, on their way through Paris, he had taken her to the Louvre, and they had stood before the little crucifixion of Mantegna. He had not been looking at the picture, or watching to see what impression it produced on Susie. His own momentary Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.